The Stones, I guess, is a good example. You wouldn't want to script that because Mick will do the similar stuff, I guess, from night to night on a song. Maybe during the song, he always goes down the catwalk or whatever. But for the most part, he's just moving around. He's wild. So if you script, you're going to miss those moments.
Hi, my name is Edgar Dabrowski. I'm a London-based DP. And welcome to the second episode of Open, Filmmakers Talk, a podcast where I interview representatives of niche filmmaking professions. Once again, I apologize for the quality of the audio. This was recorded over an Instalive. This week, I talked to Paul Dugdale, music films director. The man has shot with the Rolling Stones, The Prodigy, Adele, Taylor Swift, and Ed Sheeran. We talk battling camera positions with promoters, late-night edits and their productivity, and filming in Cuba. But I kick off by asking him, how does he shoot with artists whose music he doesn't really like?
I've done shows where we've been like a bit snooty about the music and then done the edit and ended up loving it and being like, oh, actually, these are good songs, you know, and you can get behind
it. It's like
and...
a Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But I've been really lucky. I think most of the artists, like I said, I struggled to think of someone that I'd worked with that I really wasn't into. Maybe I've just been really lucky. Maybe I'll have a stinker in the future and I'll just be like, oh my God, I just can't get into it. I always say, like, it's not a music lesson. It's about, like, you're trying to find some drama and emotion there. So regardless of the music, there's something exciting that exists in what you're filming. And so maybe you just tune it out. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, even as an audience member, like removing the fact that I worked as a DP, I watched 3-4 of your concerts in the last, say, couple of days just to kind of see what else you've done. Because Obviously I watched stuff that I like musically. So I watched Taylor Swift as well yesterday on Netflix.
Yep.
And it's an interesting show because I think that's the beauty of your eye is that it's still fun to watch even if I don't really like listen to her. I'm not her demographic potentially.
Great.
But it's just, yeah, that's sort of this fish tank moments when you're like, oh, that's interesting, almost social comment. It's kind of making observation.
Yeah. Like if you were shooting a movie, there's a reason why you cutaways of people's faces or like a thinking shot or like a little twitch of the eyes because it communicates so much. Rather than this is what they're doing, they're sat at a table and they're drinking coffee. You don't have to show that. It's about the emotion. And so our approach to music, and when I say our, I work with a team, often the same team. And so we kind of have this mutual approach, I guess, led by me, but you know, it's a mutual approach. It's not a music lesson. It's just about finding that drama. I guess because sometimes you could be like, this is a documentary. But obviously, we do so much to exaggerate the moment, to really lean in on those emotional moments. So, yeah, there's loads of things we do where you kind of exaggerate the feeling that the music is trying to create. And then hopefully it'll all hit harder when you're watching it at home, you know.
And I think it's interesting that like there's almost as much audience as artists in your shows.
I
kind of enjoy it because even if I don't like the artist, like I mentioned, you sort of just people watch and you watch different moments of them. There is like a nice beauty in the comments.
Yeah. So like we did a show for Christine and the Queens, which we also produced from scratch. So obviously she had choreo in the music, but then with Apple Music, we built Lee Lodge, Simon Fisher again, and all the amazing people at Apple Music made this concept, built a set. And it became kind of a more of a theatre show, which is what Stop Making Sense was. It was a theatre show. It wasn't about the audience. So as soon as you went to watch a play in a theatre, you wouldn't have cutaways of the people because there's no point. It's a one-way communication. The audience can be kind of passive. They're not part of the show. And so the Christine and the Queen show was like that. It was so theatrical and the way it was staged and the way we shot it was, I guess it was a little gratuitous in that we are indulgent, I suppose, in the self-indulgent where we kind of thought we're going to have to show the audience because you won't believe really that this is in the theatre otherwise because the set was so amazing. It looked like a kind of a gym.
Sorry, Paul, I'll just chip in with an extra question. That decision of not showing audience, was it made in the edit? You had
just didn't do it. Yeah, just didn't do it. And when I watch old Stones films from like 70s, 80s, I love seeing the crowd in their shows because they've spanned generations. And so you just can check out these incredible haircuts, clothes, expressions, tattoos, jewelry, all of that stuff is part of what you're seeing and it places it in a time. And so we were really conscious when we made another film for the Stones in Hyde Park. We did all that. We showed a lot of audience shots because we wanted to kind of make a record of the time. It was their 50th year being a band. And so we wanted to kind of show that. But in some of the documentary elements, We also made sure we included buses and police cars and stuff that ages really badly. You know, if you see a police car from the 80s, it looks crazy, looks insane. And you're like, oh, I was alive when that police car was like that. And now they look like completely different. And so we did all these things to try to date it purposefully, to just kind of set it in a time, you know. It's kind of going a bit off your original
question. No, but that's great. That's part of these talks. Gonna show a little bit. Let's see if this works. That's the Prodigy gig. So someone who I worked with, who worked with you, mentioned to me that you kind of give almost like a book to each camera operator of where the cameras have to be for each song.
Yeah.
And I want to ask for something like this. I think when this kicks in, you'll see what I mean. What's in the book for operators on something like this? This thing's absolutely fucking mad. What's going on? And that's, you know, that's the beauty of it, obviously.
So the book, I actually didn't use it for this film, but the book came like a few films in when I realized that I just couldn't communicate fast enough. Because it often, like with these big shows, there's so many cameras that it's hard to kind of give everybody notes, right? And in the moment. So similar to like 32, yeah, I watched that with Will and Dylan and them talking about giving DOPs roles for certain stuff. The book is like a shortcut of just saying, start the song or be in this place for this bit. So it'll have like the camera number, the operator, the lens, that's kind of more for me actually. And then for that song, it'll have a instruction of basically the just one line guide. So it's really simple. Sometimes they'll have multiple instructions and sometimes they'll actually have scripted shots to bars and beats that we know exactly where we're going to do that shot. And we've rehearsed it.
And does that mean you sort of pre-edit in your mind for each song? You sort of know how it's going to work?
It's not an edit because, well, actually, if you script it, yes. And sometimes I fully script complete concerts, right? So every shot is accounted for beforehand. But I can't do that most of the time because we just don't get the opportunity to rehearse. So if there's a touring band, they're not going to play through their set like three times in the day. It's impossible. So we have to, because we're doing it first time, giving someone a guide just gives us the best possible chance of being in the right place at the right time. With Taylor, we scripted all of the Steadicam moments on stage. So we had to choreograph, where does the Steadicam come on? Where's his shot? How does he get off? Is it dangerous? Is the choreo too kind of hectic? Is he safe? Are they safe? You know, all that kind of stuff. So it's this real sliding scale of complexity. Sometimes it's you turn up, you just shoot it. Or if you're doing a festival, most of the time it's pretty much like, okay, we're just there to cover it.
And then, say, so getting all that footage, does it often correspond to what you imagined what's going to happen in the edit? Or is edit almost like a completely separate approach to the footage?
Say there was like a band, rock band, or the Stones, I guess, is a good example. You wouldn't want to script that because Mick will do the similar stuff, I guess, from night to night on a song. Maybe like he'll know it during the song, he always goes down the catwalk or whatever. But for the most part, he's just moving around. He's wild. So if you script, you're going to miss those moments. And so you have to just react in the moment. And that's exciting. They're actually two quite different disciplines, I guess, shooting where it's like, for the most part, it's like, is there choreo? Is this a sort of a stage show? Or is this a kind of a wild, just a rock show where, you know, people are just moving wherever. And one you can script much easier than the other. Do you know what I mean?
What's the typical note, not only talking about Stones, but say everyone, Sheeran, Swift, and everyone who we work with, what's the typical note that artists come back with on the film?
I think probably the most common one is just vanity stuff, which is, you know, fair enough. So like, you know, that's a bit too close, or I've got a bit of chin on there, or that's probably the most common. And that's not to say that people try to over-sanitize. I don't think for the most part, people are kind of happy. Like Taylor, like being in the sort of in my mind with this is like, we were thinking, okay, I wonder if she's going to want like a load of painting afterwards and all that kind of stuff. And she wanted it to be real. Like, you know, it's like she's sweaty. Her hair's sticking to her face. It's like,
yeah,
amazing.
That's
I love that. Yeah,
like,
yeah. I love that. And I respect her so much for that. But on the whole, it's sort of vanity stuff, I guess. But yeah, I don't think there is a sort of one true,
like typical
common thing. Yeah.
So maybe talking a little bit about the beginnings of you with Prodigy. because he was sort of the image maker of the Prodigy and capturing their lives and kind of the wide angle lens stuff. And there's like a whole language, I think, created visually around them by you in terms of the visual captures of documenting. Can you chat a little bit? How has it evolved as well?
I was a camera assistant or cameraman-ish. It was making loads of music videos making stuff, right? I'd made a handful of videos and I was very lucky that I used to play drums in a band. So we were kind of mixing with lots of musicians, and one guy who became a friend was a guy called Kid Harpoon, Tom Hull. And Kid Harpoon is now like an incredible producer in Los Angeles, and he just produced the Harry Styles new album and a bunch of other stuff. But anyway, at that point he was playing in North London in pubs and he was doing well, he was touring, but he was crucially signed to XL Records. So I started making music videos for him, but they were so cheap, literally zero budget basically. But we were just making stuff. So I was getting to sort of do my own thing, which was a real breakthrough for an artist who was signed to an actual record label, an amazing label. And everyone at XL was so supportive and amazing from my early career, just, you know, really do owe them a lot. And so by doing that, then lovely lady called Cordelia Plunkett, who was the partner of the Prodigy's manager, was working at a production company I was working at. And someone had said, Doug does like make some of his own stuff. You should just, you know, check him out. And so
how old are you at that stage?
So at that point, I'm 28.
So and super young, not like a 16 year old.
No, not at all. But the funny thing is, and this is like so bad because it dates me so bad, that when I was doing that with them, a 5D didn't exist. Like, you couldn't shoot on a nice lens. There was no camera like that. And the only way you could do it was get like a PD150 or whatever it was and have a Litus adapter and then the glass, and then your camera was like that long.
And at an angle as well.
Yeah. So it's like, it's so weird because when I think of it now, the camera world has changed so much, even since I was doing it. And so not that that was the reason why I was so old, I guess, but you couldn't pick up a camera and shoot.
Did it dictate aesthetics of it as well? Because it's a hurt.
Yes, a little bit. Because I think I might have been tempted to make their Prodigy work more glossy and more filmic. Where actually it worked because it was video and I could stab the zoom really hard with it. I had like a little, you know, a little stick thing. And so you could make it really rough and really aggressive, and that's what it needed. But anyway, so first meeting with the Prodigy, I went in and I was really proud of all these music videos and was showing them all this stuff. And they were kind of very polite about it, but they were like, have you got anything else that's got a bit more, you know, grit behind it? And the only thing that I had on my laptop was this film that I'd made from a load of my friends used to run an indie night at the Astoria called Frog. And everyone used to go every week and it was just chaos and really drunken and
right, that Prodigy
sloppy, right? Yeah. And I had a little camcorder and a little fisheye lens and just filmed that night, and it was just chaos and crazy. And I just did it for my friends and uploaded it on like probably MySpace or something, and then showed them that, and it had like people throwing up in it and like friends, but like, you know, it was just full on
bodily fluids on a fisheye lens.
It was a home movie, but it was cut to the Ace of Spades, the Motorhead song. And so it was just like aggressive and rough and raw. And they were just like, yeah, that's it. Yeah, you do that. And so we were like, oh, okay, fine. Yeah, okay, get it. Yeah, so that's what we did. And then basically I spent 4 years doing that. That was the, obviously like not every job, I haven't got any other jobs in that way, but they were sort of the keys to the kingdom in terms of working with a high profile artist and someone that people that I just loved and idolized as a kid and still do, you know.
Sort of became the almost like a diarist to an extent, because I watched this YouTube montage of, I think it says Prodigy directed by Dugdale or something, and there's just like 1.5 hours of these
man, there's loads of it. Yeah,
early vlog stuff of laughing, signing some stuff. There is a kind of observational quality to it. And I wonder if that like observation stayed with you, that then leaked into music films as well, that it's never just the performance. There's always this kind of veneer around and inside the concert sometimes. Also, my question is, what was the purpose of capturing stuff for them at that stage? Was it early social media?
Yes, it's interesting you asked that, because I was going to say earlier, at that point in 2008, don't get me wrong, there was content being made by artists, but not loads. And they were amongst the first people to really kind of use that as a tool. You know, the manager, John Fares, was like just keyed into it, I guess. And that was why they did it. But yeah, we did like 60, 70 films by the end. Yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah, it's nuts. You have all sorts. I watched that clip. There's like stuff about stage collapse in Moscow.
Yeah.
All sorts of interesting. Yeah. So people, if you're interested in that whole side of it, yeah, just go YouTube it. There is stuff there. Did you ever think to put, say, this stuff on pause for a year, do some music videos, commercials, or you're just so busy you don't really need other stuff, you know?
No, I've thought about it, and I like that. I do love the idea of doing something scripted or like doing a doc that isn't music, but at the moment, it's sort of strange. I came to this realization the other day that people often take the piss out of me because I'm not like a movie buff, even though I'm a director, but I don't watch tons of movies. Obviously, I love film and I love filmmaking, but I think I probably love music more. Mm-hmm. And so there's this interesting thing where the music kind of keeps dragging me back, you know, I'm sure I've got some scripted in me and a doc that isn't music, but for now, I can't tear myself away from it because I love it too much.
And I guess it's a nice wave to ride as well.
It's great. You know, you feel it that shows aren't happening now. It's kind of a cliche, but you know, you realize what you got when it's gone, and you kind of, we picked up a project continuing an edit a couple of weeks back, and it was a show that we'd started and we were just kind of finishing it and picking it back up. And you just suddenly had this enormous renewed kind of rejuvenated enthusiasm for it, because it was just like, wow, look at all those people, you know. It was kind of a shock, even though you were there in the room. Yeah, I just love it.
Talk to me about the difference between the live and capturing for non-live, because you have this kind of interesting big thing with Coldplay recently where they played in Jordan. It was streamed to YouTube, if I'm correct. I think I watched it on YouTube. So this was kind of on a rooftop in Jordan and streamed, captured live. It was like a live edit. So what are the differences in shooting for live and for capture?
Well, the main difference is you really do only have one go. So, you know, for some shows, we'll shoot a show twice. Most of the time it's for the comfort of the artist. You know, like often they'll just want two shows to pick the audio from. What that allows us to do is obviously have more options to choose from. So there's a nice safety blanket because we can film more. We have more options in the edit. You know that you don't have to nail it first time. Also, my sort of two key sort of lead editors, Simon Bryant and Tom Watson, are like super amazing. And, you know, we'll be frame fucking a cut like within an inch of its life. Every frame counts. So we're much more super precise in a post-produced film. But there's an energy that comes from doing something live that I don't think you can recreate. And especially a film like this Coldplay thing was just totally extraordinary. And I've never really, it's a total different thing from anything we'd done before. It was super amazing. Incredible vision mixer called Dan Winterburn, who just cut it all live. But we also, with this one, we, even though it was live, we were shooting large format. We were doing a live grade, like a true live, or on the program live grade, not just, you know, not just racking cameras. It was like a grading in real time, just like really pushing the tech for the right reasons. And yeah, it was a really humbling project to be part of. More than any other, it was such a team game because everyone was so new to this weird thing that we were trying to achieve. And both, so that we did two shows, both live to air, one at sunrise and one at sunset. And so, you know, you're in this Jordanian citadel on the top of the city at like 3 a.m. waiting for the sun to come up, hearing call to prayer and all that kind of stuff. It was just totally amazing. Everyone, the band and crew, everyone just really had an incredible experience, life experience, you know.
You seem pretty, and you are, I'm sure, pretty technical as director. Does that come from sort of the camera background? Are you involved much technically in the show? Is it something you would discuss a lot in prep for something like that even? Because surely there's a massive technology behind to stream it live and great.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't take any credit for the way the tech is done. And we work with a guy called Volker Lauter at SR Films, and producer that I mentioned before, Simon Fisher, both geniuses and particularly well-versed in all the tech stuff. I guess my sort of tech knowledge is most valuable, I think, in camera placement and knowing lenses quite well. But actually, you know, doing large format, everything changes, and I'm fairly unfamiliar with that because we don't get to do that much multicam. So the camera placement and the type of application we use, like, okay, is this a tower cam? Is it a remote dolly? Is it a normal dolly? You know, all of that kind of the tools that we would use, I'm really precise with, and I know what each thing can get me and what I need to achieve.
Do you do much previs? Sort of previs with
lens? No. For the stuff we've done, no. But like if I was doing an award show or maybe something which would have a set already or a set built purposefully for it so that, you know, they're doing a sort of 3D model in previs anyway, then yes, maybe we would. It is done sometimes, but actually for the most part, it's just a matter of using that little, whatever the app is on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
And just looking at shot sizes, yeah, whatever that is. And
so that comes from just experience, right? It's sort of knowing where to place.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've always had sort of really aware that that's always been in my arsenal of like, because just from purely coming from a camera background. So yeah, it's, I think I have a try anyway to have a good sense, a good balance of like what I'll need for an edit. But I think the interesting thing with the, going back to the Prodigy briefly, was I shot sort of, you know, came up with a concept, if there is a concept for those, it's just mayhem basically, but also shot and cut them. And when I started with them, the only editing I'd done was for my own music films where I could do it over a week or whatever, music videos. And I really taught myself. And then the Prodigy films, I had to like cut a film every week. So, you know, I'm not a very good technical editor, but my sort of timing and the way that they get constructed is kind of, I'm sort of very conscious of. So I think that also helped inform camera choice and understanding really how an edit works and all that kind of stuff. I always say to cameramen and women, camera people, that they should try to just get to an edit. They would learn so much. Like I learned so much.
True.
I would be, you're so much such a better camera operator from understanding how an edit
how
works.
Is it and, used, you know, yeah, massive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh man, big time.
I'm lucky to have sat in a couple doc edits, learn masses.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah,
usually I learned so like important. Fuck, needed more GVs, needed a bit more
yeah.
yeah, to help glue some stuff. But there's there's the meat, but then there's this texture on top of the meat. You're like, oh fuck, why did I not give them extra like 5 shots? Could have done it. The pitching process. So do you still pitch? What's in the treatment, for example, when you approach the jobs? How does that work at this stage?
Yeah, I do sometimes and sometimes I don't. Sometimes projects just literally come to me. Sometimes I'm pitching against other people. It's a total mixture.
And if you pitch against other people, is it like a book or is it just a page of ideas?
No, I do a book. Yeah. Yeah, I do a book. For the most part, most of the music films, not all, but most of them, have some kind of documentary element or a kind of an actual structured device that is more than just a concert. So the live part of it is like, okay, well, say the Stones' Olé, Olé, Olé was, so the film that you can watch on Netflix. Yeah, there's a full treatment for a documentary.
And interestingly, you still had to basically do a treatment for them?
So the reason we did that was they got in touch with us direct. And we said, yes, and I think originally it was like, would you like to film a concert in Cuba? The answer is yes, obviously. But then we see an opportunity. It's like, okay, well, you're playing Cuba. That's a big story. Then we found out, oh, you're also touring South America. And then you're like, okay, how about this? And so then we put a pitch together that they wouldn't have necessarily thought about and said, look, we can make you this. Do you want to try and do it? Mm-hmm. And so
just to brief viewers in, there's two things Paul has done for that show. There's a doco, which is on Netflix called Olé Olé Olé. And then there's an actual concert film, which is separate. I think I bought it yesterday on
Amazon. Yeah, Havana Moon is
called. So it's two different films, yeah.
So that was kind of an unusual one. So like with the Ed Sheeran film, again, we sort of wrote a treatment. And I think we probably pitched against other people and wrote about just about the way we would approach the filming of the live, but also critically, it was like, they wanted some documentary and it was like, how are you going to do this documentary? Mm-hmm. You only got him for those days.
Mm-hmm.
For that one, I sort of just came up with a simple structure that we thought, okay, well, this is a device that will make this into a film because we know we don't have much time with him. So, and it became this sort of Groundhog Day. He was doing 3 Wembley stadiums in a row. So we made it like Groundhog Day, but the Groundhog Day was, he was playing Wembley Stadium, which was like insane. And so it was a totally very simple concept, but it just kind of helped glue it together because there wasn't that much content. You know, we were just filming him do it and learning about his experience in kind of real time. But I guess that, yeah, the concept of the documentary is probably a bit more than the live, because they just, I sort of presume that often that an artist will feel quite comfortable just having seen what you've made before, you know. Although I've been in positions, I've pitched on stuff where artists have seen, have said, oh yeah, can you do a treatment? And I've written a treatment, and then the feedback has been like, oh no, they didn't want to do it because you'd worked with X, and I don't want it because not them. And it's, which is so obviously ridiculously short-sighted.
Pop diva moment?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, it's more kind of like, in this case, it was old, credible rockers. In this case, it wasn't even a pop artist. It was someone else. Oh. And they were like, no, that's not for us, which is fine. But you kind of go, oh, I think you should have dug a bit deeper. And if they'd seen Prodigy, then that probably would have been too far the other way, maybe. Who knows?
Like in commercials, you sort of, the question is, have you done something similar before? If you haven't worked for that particular band.
Yeah, right.
See
right.
something yeah. in that round.
Yeah, yeah. And, I get it. I suppose if you haven't done anything similar, then you might be a little nervous. But part of the fun for me is to explore the different genres. Prodigy's super fun, but, you know, then you do choreo and you do this super, like, tight Taylor Swift, like, bam, 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 you know, and really follow the choreo of that show.
Is there certain gangs in that world? So if you've done Taylor Swift, you can't do Beyonce. Or if you've done Ed Sheeran, you can't do this. And is it...
to be honest, if there is, I don't know about it. But maybe, yeah, maybe that's why there are some of those artists are missing. Yeah,
it actually leads me into... I have this question regards the kind of innovation of the image. Meaning, say, Ed Sheeran comes, you know, you pitch, you win it. How much then can you really shift the image of an artist? Or does a star of that size come with their own lookbook, basically, saying what you can or can't do? Or Taylor Swift. How much can you suggest to make something... Like, for example, the sweat on Swift's head towards the end. Is it like you had to almost pitch it that she's not going to be made up? Or is it just how she is and it's fine?
No, that's a good question, because I think with everything I've made, it's a real collaboration with the artist and they have final cut and whatever. And that's fine with me, because all I want to do is serve the music and serve them. I just want to sort of become the band, become part of the band and blend into the background and deliver their sort of best possible version of themselves. In that sense, I'm not precious about if an artist has a note like that, then that's totally fine by me, because it's kind of their thing. And I, at the end of the day, they've designed their show, they're doing their songs, that's just another thing that they're doing, and we just follow it. What becomes annoying is, like for everyone I guess that makes films, is if you have a note that you know isn't from the artist, that's from like a girlfriend or boyfriend, or is kind of such we did a film again that I won't name, but whose partner of the lead singer was doing a lot of the notes, and they were just insane. But you kind of just had to go with it. And we were calling the manager going, this is insane. Like, what are you sure you want to do this? And they were like, yeah, we just have to, because the artists will want it that way. And
it's not it. how much power these people have, I have to say. I have the same for pretty good rock band where video was out for half an hour. And then I think wife of the lead or something said something about one of the shots and they pulled the whole video. It was out already.
Right, right.
They're like, okay, it's the lead, so you can't put it anywhere on your reels. Someone's like, God, you're kidding me. Like, how do you even come up with that sort of comment?
It's but I guess it's like, you know, I guess it's just the same as if you're doing a commercial and the client's like, no, I don't really like that. And you're like, what? You know, I had that when I was making music videos, and you'd have commissioners giving you notes, of course, and rightly so, but you'd just be, oh man, really? That bit? And you just got to roll with the punches.
But someone like, relatively, I was watching as my girlfriend, both of us noticed that the sweat on Taylor's head by towards the end and kind of how rough she started to look. Is that almost a deliberate choice or was it accidental and then left in? Like, because it's a massive star. Oh, we understand the polishedness of the image.
Well, I can't speak on her behalf.
But it was never questioned, right?
It was questioned. We talked about it because I think we were assuming that it would get painted. So some of it like would get painted. And like I said earlier, I respect her so much for just not, it's just like, no, that's how it was. And that's real. I think it's like, that's rock and roll. You know what I mean? Like, why would I do that? And, you know, I love that she isn't a sanitized, glossy, manipulated image thing. It's
did you show her your early throwing up film, like you showed the
product? No, she didn't get that one.
Taylor, she didn't
see that one as the that wasn't in the pitch. Yeah.
Right. Do you feel your drumming past kind of influenced the tightness of your edits as well?
I think so. I think to a certain extent. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of cameramen actually who are good at filming music, and a lot of vision mixers and editors are all either musicians or good dancers. There is definitely something in it. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it's not a scientific thing, but they certainly... There's something there.
Anticipation, you sort of know, okay, this is four quarters coming up. This is
exactly.
Because I imagine, filming Prodigy, there must be so much involvement in timing the pan to like the roughness of it. And otherwise, if you miss it, you sort of partially miss it in a way. Saves you in the edit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, there totally is. And you can feel it, in an edit, you can feel who's just tuned into it. Because a lot of the people that I work with now were cameramen when I was an assistant, so we have already had a great friendship. And again, we seem to sort of speak the same language, or they know now what I like because I try to get a lot of the same people back often. So
what's the process? So you get a set list of sorts, the songs and the order, and you start working down it. Talk me through what happens then. The venue, for example. And so, how much time do you have in prep for something of that size?
Well, it really depends. Like, sometimes it can be 6 months, sometimes it can be a couple of weeks. So it really depends. But no, first port of call would be the camera plan. And then as you get closer, you go and see a couple of shows. Then my process is normally...
On tour, so you go on tour.
Oh, yeah. And we often meet the artist at that time as well. Chat about what they want to do, what their expectations are. And I always ask them what music films they like, if any, and see if they are into anything that I can kind of go, okay, well, they like that, I always try to do something, it's not just an off the peg capture, it's bespoke to that artist. So it needs to suit them and their music. And then go to maybe do a recce at the venue, do a camera plan, argue about the budget. Budgets are budgets. So it always ends up being scaled back in some way. I don't think I've ever done a job that hasn't been. But, we still end up with, the luxury of a lot of equipment sometimes.
So you get a track list, for example, you come up with angles then, or you come up based on the camera positions you're allowed to have?
Yeah, because you rely on, there's so many factors because you...
For example, just to kind of give you lead in, I was involved in one capture of a live gig in like an arena size. And that's when I first time learned you have to basically request to clear certain seats, which I never even thought about. So because behind you, no one can stand.
Yes, exactly.
So my dictates that to you. You say,
well, to kind of put it in perspective, my most nerve-wracking moment of any project, and I guess this is kind of goes across the board really, is the day or the afternoon where we walk around a venue with the promoter, whoever the venue representative. Maybe someone, the production manager from the band, my DOP, maybe a camera supervisor, the tech manager and a producer and me. We'll walk around every position and go, okay, so there's going to be a 6-foot tower here to get on the eye line of the stage. It's going to be this high. It's going to cast a shadow where you're going to not be able to sell these seats of X amount of people. And so once we do that meeting and everyone has gone, okay, you can do that, then I have a huge sense of one relief, but also like, if it's gone well, confidence in what the film will be. If you're doing a live gig, you're at the mercy of those camera positions. And so you can move during the show, but you still have to move within the mojo. You're not allowed on stage, or maybe you can go on a specific part of the stage. It's incredibly structured. So yeah, you have to, I was talking once to a friend of mine about like, with the type of work that I do specifically, and actually I guess it goes, I'm sure it will be the same for many directors, the styles of direction. You have to be creative, but there's a lot of like really homework and sort of planning, quite tech planning stuff that goes into it.
Well, just to put it in perspective for the guys and girls listening, how many cameras is your typical show?
I think Taylor was the most, and we did two nights, and the total amount of streams that the editors had to work with was 56. So they have 56 shots to choose from. What you do is have a core set that remain the same. So for example, with Taylor,
which is
it would
what,
be
like 17, 20?
Well, hard to say. No, less than that. I would say probably like a core, in her case, which is a stadium. It really varies if depending on the size of the stadium, the type of show, etc. Which is why
Sheeran is a good average example, because it's one person. It's a
well. The thing is with Sheeran. The thing is, it's interesting you say that. So there's two ways of thinking. One is it's one guy, so it's easy to capture. Right. But if you don't have many cameras and it's one guy, it's just going to be the same thing over and over. But actually with him, it wasn't huge. I think he was about 14, something like that, which sounds a lot, but in a stadium, you could go a lot more. And obviously like with Taylor's numbers were high, but partly because we had a lot of cameras on her band and you couldn't see the band all the time. So we had to have a way of seeing the band for bits where they weren't visible anywhere else. So we had to have a lot of additional cameras to capture them. And it was a generous plot because she had, I think it was sort of 8 unique performance areas. So 3 areas on the main stage, 2 B stage, C stage. She was also flying. It was in the round, like all of those things will lift the amount of camera numbers. So yeah, it really varies.
And then the general, like if you get to the edit, is the general attitudes then to kind of build the main block, the skeleton of each song, and then kind of spice it up and neat it up? Or you go chronologically, basically bit by bit? How many days a song do you usually have?
We try to do a day and a half per 3 minutes. And that includes my notes. So I would do, my process is, I like to just let them do it, get on with it. And I like to do it remotely as well, to start with, because I think I can rewatch stuff over and over like a total maniac and not feel guilty that the editor who's seen it already about 50 times at that point is sitting me going, can I just see it again? Can I see it again? Can I see it again? So I like to just get it sent remotely or watch a quick time or however we're doing it. Sometimes I'll be in the edit suite, sometimes I'll be at home, but I'll be
sometimes
watching
it. You out.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we do that and I do 2 or 3 rounds of remote notes like that. So we'd literally like edit, sending back notes. We get it to a point, and then my favorite part of probably the whole process, entire process of making the film, is me and the editor sitting together and then just fine cutting and rewatching the rushes and just exploring if there's anything that they've overlooked or they didn't think that I would like, all that stuff. And then it's just wonderful that part of the process, because it's such a true collaboration. And we second guess each other. Yeah. And you leave that day knowing that you've made all of those cuts that you already thought were good because they've been through like, you know, 3 versions or whatever. You know, you leave that day going, oh my God, we've really mined that gold and we've got everything, the very best out of it. And so, and that process has been, I think, has been really important. The edit part of this kind of multi-camera capture can be easily overlooked. And I think is an important part of our process to kind of get a
You probably do, but what's the point when you do get tired looking at the show? Is there a point where you're like, okay, I can't make decisions anymore because it all seems, I've watched it so many times. Do you strive for like a deadline for yourself? It's like, I'm just not going to make a good decision past that day.
No, I only get like that if it's like, if we're doing a late night. And we started off doing that where we would end up doing silly hours, and which is fine. And obviously that works for some people, but I kind of realized that just doesn't work for me. I don't like working under that pressure where you're like, you're either working really late at night and you start to make decisions based on just wanting to go home, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, we do go late sometimes. If we have to, certainly we'll go late, but we try to avoid that too much. But in general, I don't really get sick of it. The worst thing about it, I suppose, is that sometimes you just can't listen to that artist for a while because you've done those songs so much and you need a break. And there are some where you don't have that and some where you do. And yeah, there's no real rule to it. But yeah, sometimes I'm just like, okay, I can't listen to that band for a while. But it's kind of nice to have a break, I guess.
I can imagine. Listen, I have a few more. And then
okay,
because there's people asking as well. I want to get into the shoot night a little bit because we haven't, like, we've discussed obviously vaguely and stuff. During the shoot, because that's been planned, everyone gets the books and notepads of where they're meant to be. Do you then monitor live and how much of it you manage on the night? Do you have comms and you kind of ask them to do certain or what's the approach there?
Yeah. So they have my notes in this book. And then I think the camera operators will sort of translate them into however they want to do it. If they have it on like a smaller bit of paper or whatever, translate those notes. So, you know, if there's 20 cameras and they're all on monitors in front of me, it's impossible to look at them all at the same time. I think as a multi-camera director, you get good at sort of scanning, looking at multiple things, making sure everything's moving at the same pace, making sure everything coverage-wise is there. I think that kind of comes maybe with practice. But there'll be a camera that, you know, is less important, that is right down the mixer, like way over there. And it's important that they know at the start of that song, please be wide, or please, like, they're going to be fireworks for this wide. Say, most of the time, it will be like a wide camera or a audience camera that I don't have to look at the whole time. And it will be like, okay, there's fireworks at the start of this track, so start wide. And I don't have to check,
is that
camera wide, because it's too late. I'll have that in my notes. And maybe actually, as the song before it's ending, sometimes I'll have a little glance and I will have highlighted some key things that I need to communicate from the start of the next song. So yeah, so that's really the way of doing it, or the way I do it anyway. And I probably talk way too much and don't really allow anyone to listen to the music. Actually, I guess if there aren't many cameras, I probably don't do that. But if there's a big show, you just have to spend quite a lot of time talking, because you have a lot to say and a lot of comment, to ensuring that there's a cohesive pace of everything.
I saw like a little bit, I didn't know in which BTS, you sound polite, which was kind of a nice, you're like very polite with your notes.
I can't remember
which show was it, but I was like, oh, there's Doug on the desk.
Yeah, we did a show that was really high pressure.
Have you ever lost
it? Yeah, well, I've never completely lost it, but I did a show once where, I won't go into the detail, but we just had this awful thing happen before the show, which was so frustrating to everyone. And there was just suddenly there was a lot riding on us, mm-hmm. keeping our noses clean. And that piled on an enormous pressure. And I think that was the only time I was kind of, because there was so much pressure, it was probably a little over the top in my in my communication. But you apologize afterwards, and it's the heat of the moment. I don't do that a lot. I hope that I try to be polite, because I remember when I was the cameraman, you know, so I remember what it's like. And I remember what it's like to get praise. And what effect that has on people, and how you can, you know, you're trying to encourage people to do their best job, and you don't get that by being mean to them or shouting at them.
Do you do sort of a sports coachy thing? Because I saw behind the scenes where you sit down and kind of talk to to get them in the mood.
Yeah, it's more, to be honest, I think it's more just communicating what we want the film to feel like. And obviously, I'll hype them up and encourage everybody to do a good job. A lot of the time, especially when we're doing a show that has two shows, I will encourage them to take chances, because there's nothing worse than you've got all your notes and you're like, oh my God, I really hope I don't fuck this up. And you've got to, you're really focused. When you're focusing, that's not a good way to be creative. And so obviously there's a lot of cues and there's a lot of things to remember, but also you still want those people to be at their best and at their most creative.
Freedom leads to creation. Yeah.
I'll often say, just take chances. Like, don't worry about the consequences. We've got enough, hopefully got enough footage. We've got enough cameras that you will be okay. It's like that kind of who dares wins vibe. You've got to push it. You've got to fly close to the wind to get the best. And so I want people to try and land shots and framing and focus that they think, fuck, I might not get this. And feel confident that if it's a disaster, it's not a problem and we won't using it. But if they land it, it's fucking amazing. And the film would be better and I'll love it.
Rick Mind asks, what is the most important quality you look for in the camera operator for live performance?
Well, it's just finding opportunities. So like, I remember when I was a cameraman and like doing, especially like doing festivals, you know, there wasn't really, you just had to film what's in front of you and try and make it good. You're just thinking all the time, okay, I'm going to do that. And after that, I'm going to do this. And you're sort of thinking two shots ahead to give variety and change of movement. And okay, now I'm going to go tight. Now I'm going to go offering wide. And you're just switching it up all the time. I just love that, where someone's just giving you content. You know what I mean? So they're just giving you so much. So I guess in your world, or in it's like a single camera world, it would be like, you know, there's a scene that you're covering and you're just getting great. You just, when you come to the edit, you're like, oh wow, we've got so much different coverage. It's not just like, okay, we're just going to sit on this, whatever it is, two shot or whatever. It's like two shot. We've also got this big wide cutaway and we've got like these details and whatever. You're just really exhausting every option. And so for us in an edit, it's invaluable, because the cameras are in a set position if they're not moving cameras. So you need variety. And so the more creative a cameraman can be for me, the better. I love it. I love seeing them going, just being creative or throwing focus and pulling it back or moving from one person to another, just creating moves, finding stuff. If you were doing a drama, that might be a direction. And sometimes it is, actually. Sometimes I will say, okay, go into the drummer and then pull back and reveal the bass player or something like that, you know. And of course there's direction like that, but if there's someone doing that without you even asking, amazing.
What's your thing with the lighting designers? Is it show per show, and do you have much, like, can you tell them to calm down for certain stuff, or do you tell them to make it big for certain stuff? How do you balance those exposures, for example, on something?
Yeah, so I've worked with the same DOP for like virtually all of the films, who's Brett Turnbull, who's amazing, sort of world best multicam live DOP. He's done so many concerts, not just of mine, of like, you know, so he's so technical and a lovely, lovely chap. But he'll work with most of the time for us, obviously the lighting design is ready made for a tour. If we're not doing a bespoke show, if it's a tour show. So the lighting will just be as the tour is. Sometimes we'll bolster the audience lighting a little, but sometimes not, because some artists don't like that and it's very expensive. So for the budget, we don't do it. And then they will run cue to cue with the LD to make sure that DOP will run cue to cue with the LD to make sure that everything's balanced.
LDs is lighting designer, just for those listening. It's they have certain, like, they have a, like, this easy to do it, or is there a bit of a fight back because LDs want to make it look good live? Or do they understand the power of concert film these days?
No, in that instance, I think for the most part, they play quite nicely. Yeah, it's quite a good teamwork, because they know that ultimately their lighting is going to look bad if they don't. Like, this is, you know, it'll be a big film and it'll be a recording forever, and their lighting isn't going to look good if they don't listen to that person. It's as simple as that. The most friction we come up against is like turning down LED screens. Often we have to, you know, run LED screens that would normally be really bright and punchy and beautiful and really saturated color. We have to turn them down to like 10% in order to balance those against the lights that are on stage. And also, obviously, if you're looking at someone who's spotlit, they're going to look a lot brighter than a crowd. So yeah, so all of that stuff.
And on a tour, you have enough time to do it, because before the show.
The theory is that the DOP would have a camera at least. Hopefully more by that point, but sometimes it's just a sole camera. I mean, so actually sometimes this doesn't happen, because sometimes you can go in on a day that the show will go in on the same day as the camera rig. But if it's the day before, which is often the case, the DOP will stay overnight with the show LD, and they'll just run it with a camera and then be running around with the light meter and charts and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'm very grateful. It's a part of the process that I don't really get involved in.
Yeah, so because it's two teams working, but the goal is sort of same in the end.
Absolutely.
A good
live
show and a good film show.
Yeah. And I think for the most part, I mean, obviously in a live show, they will be precious about how it feels, but I hope that what we do doesn't mess with it too much that it ruins everyone's, you know, experience by any means.
Becky's saying, bloody hell, I miss working. Becky Powers.
Yeah, Becky Powers.
Paul, thank you so much. It was fun chat, and I'm sure.
Thanks, man. And if anyone else has any questions, just feel free to drop me a line on, I don't know, Instagram or Twitter or whatever. I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Awesome.
Great, man.
Well, good to
thanks so much.
Finally.
Yeah, you too, man. You too. Yeah, it's really nice to chat.
A year back and forth, right?
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll get to do something together one day.
Yeah, we'll
hope so.
So awesome. Paul, thanks,
cool.
Mate.
Thanks, everybody, for watching. Appreciate it.
And safe and healthy lockdown.
You too. You too. Take it easy.
All right, mate.
Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Dugdale. Next week, I talk to Ben Spencer, commercials and long-form DP, who shot the second season of End of the Fucking World. It's a duo episode of sorts. Both of us will discuss the mistakes we've made in our career, big and small. So subscribe to get the notification when it's out, and share this episode if you enjoyed it. Really helps a small podcast like this to grow. And see you next week.